Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you very much for joining us. Our guests are Paul Jenkins of the Anchorage Daily Planet, Sean Dugan of KTVA Channel 11, and Greg Erickson of the Alaska Budget Report. Paul, the Alaska Public Offices Commission says outside groups, independent groups, following the United States Supreme Court, can spend whatever they want in political campaigns. Provide us with the specifics and who exactly is Alaskans deserve better.
I don't think anybody knows.
Although we all believe it.
As of today, Alaska Deserves Better has not filed with the Alaska Public Offices Commission. They're waiting for them to do it any time now. Their lawyer says he's not at liberty to say who they are. What they did was they asked the APOC for a specific ruling, an advisory opinion, if you will, on whether, I think it's a Citizens United Supreme Court decision 2010, applies up here, applies to Alaska, would apply to Alaska Deserves Better, whether they can spend, take in and spend unlimited amounts of cash. APOC reviewed the Supreme Court ruling, other federal rulings, and realized that, yeah, Constitution applies here too, and now they're going to have unlimited spending and collection abilities in this upcoming election. What it means for the election is that independent groups like this, and this was an organization-specific ruling, by the way. This was, they asked the question, the answer applies to them. Their lawyer and every other
lawyer. We're
talking
about Alaskans deserve
right.
better.
But what happens is it will wind up applying to all of them. So there's going to be a lot of money in this election.
And I guess we'll start seeing that money being spent pretty soon, I would assume.
I would think so. I would imagine media buys are probably by the pound now, right?
Greg, you reported that the Parnell administration commissioners, the commissioners administration, met earlier this week to discuss purchasing pension obligation bonds. Why would they be doing this, and what do they hope to accomplish?
Well, as most people know, the state has a couple of large pension systems, one for teachers and the other for public employees. Those endowments need about $28 billion in order to meet their ongoing obligations for annuities to our employees and teachers. They only have about $18 billion in them, so there's a big shortfall, $10 billion shortfall. 4 years ago, Representative Mike Hawker and former state treasurer, the late Brian Andrews, pushed through legislation which would authorize $5 billion worth of pension obligation bonds. What's a pension obligation bond? You go into the bond market as a state, you borrow $5 billion or some other amount, and you put it in the endowment of the pension fund. You pay low interest rates on the bond indebtedness, and hopefully you earn high earnings on your stock market and other diversified investments. That's the theory. It looked like a really good deal back in early 2008, but in September of 2008, interest rates went through the roof as the world economy sort of imploded, and the whole idea got stuck on the shelf. Last week, it got taken off the shelf, and I think what's happening is that the folks at Treasury and I think the folks at administration think it's a really good idea. And frankly, if there's ever a time to do it, I think right now is the time, because state taxable borrowing in the bond market would be around 3 or 4%. And the 20-year average return on pension investments is almost 8%.
Greg, do we have any other examples from other states that could perhaps tell us what could happen?
Well, there are some abject examples of the bad things that can happen. Illinois is a good example of states that have sort of in a panic used this borrowing as a way to take care of a short-term problem in meeting their liabilities. We don't have that here. We have a plan in place to meet those pension obligations. It's just costing us $200-400 million a year in extra deposits to these funds. And that worries the fiscal analysts and legislators. So with a huge spread we've got between the projected long-term earnings and the borrowing costs, it probably makes good sense. But the results of this meeting last week were very fuzzy. And I think what we can say is that the Commissioner of Administration, the Commissioner of Commerce, and the Commissioner of Revenue really don't know where Sean Parnell is going to be.
Well,
on
I
this.
Wondered about this.
And so they don't want to take any moves that would sort of preclude his going either way. I called Representative Mike Hocker up and interviewed him yesterday about this proposal. They had never contacted him or even talked to him about this. Now, to have the most influential person in the legislature sort of be out of the loop, to me, sort of suggests that they don't really know where the governor is.
Okay. Sean Dugan, an Anchorage police officer, shoots and kills a citizen during a confrontation here in Anchorage. Mm-hmm. What happened that night, and what process is now underway of review in the police department and in the community?
Well, about the only thing that's clear is the process. Everybody wants to know what happened, especially the community. So it was the 6th of June, or 9th of June, excuse me, where it was about 9:25 at night, North Bunn Street. Police officers get a call that a guy's acting aggressively. He's got his shirt off. He's allegedly yelling at neighborhood kids and attacking somebody's dog. So the officer pulls up. He's a 26-year-old kid, graduated from Bartlett in 2002, you know, at the 4.0. He's got three kids. He pulls up, and the police say the man came at him aggressively with what was initially described as a baton. Now, since then, it's been described as a stick, a staff, and other things.
It's been downgraded and then upgraded.
Upgraded. No one knows exactly what he was carrying. Some of the neighbors claim it was a cut-off broomstick, but in either case, it could be used in the correct way, a deadly weapon. So the police officer, 26-year-old Boaz Johnson, pulls his service revolver. He doesn't have a taser. Now, not every Anchorage police officer, surprisingly enough, is equipped with tasers, which are, of course, designed to take people down without killing them. All the troopers have them. APD's in the process of getting more. They're about 1,000 apiece. They have 150 now. I think they're getting 30 more soon. But he doesn't have a taser, pulls out his service weapon, and he shoots the guy, dies. A lot of the people in the neighborhood are upset. They feel like the APD should have done something, or the officer involved should have done something other than use deadly force. Exactly the circumstances, we don't know. APD's being pretty tight-lipped. We've been talking to them just about every single day. They do say they're going to have a press conference next week. Now, in this case, the State Office of Special Prosecutions is looking into it, and they're going to determine if criminal charges are justified. If they're not, APD still has an internal investigation, so even if criminal charges weren't justified, the officer could face discipline up to and including termination there, or they could decide that it was completely justified, and then he would be, you know, back in the rotation. But I think one of the things people don't realize is that, you know, there's been a lot of talk about why didn't he wound the guy if he could have, and, you know, when police officers, they're trained, first of all, not to retreat, but they're trained when they pull their service revolver, shoot to kill. You don't want to shoot to wound somebody because, first of all, you have a greater likelihood of missing, and secondly, if it's dangerous enough to pull your service weapon, then they figure you better be shooting to kill.
And they don't want to extend the incident or have it get further out of control.
Absolutely.
Once again, I'm Michael Carey. I'm here with Paul Jenkins, Greg Erickson, and Sean Dugan. Greg, prices for Alaska North Slope oil dropped once again to their lowest level since February of 2011. Some experts think the downturn is merely temporary. Others think we may be on the edge of the bubble burst as the high prices reach steady decline. You've been looking at oil prices since the late 60s. What do we have here? Bubble burst or temporary decline?
Well, if I knew that, I'd be rich.
Yeah.
But I'm certainly on the bubble side of the opinion. The current oil prices, Alaska oil prices, were down to $99, and that is the lowest level per barrel since February of 2011. But it isn't out of line with the kind of variations we've been seeing over the last 3 years, really. But I think more importantly and more of more concern is the fact that world oil production has risen at the time that world oil consumption is falling. And the United States is using less oil now than it has in many, many years and is producing more oil. And a lot of people think, well, China and India are growing so rapidly, and they are. Their consumption of petroleum is going up, but not nearly fast enough to offset those declines elsewhere. Part of this has to do with natural gas becoming very abundant, and there are a lot of other factors involved as well. But just to look in the long run, in 2005, oil consumption has grown only 0.5%, while oil reserves over the same period are up 13%. Back in 1980, oil reserves were enough to provide 29 years of supply. Today, there are enough oil reserves to supply the world for 50 years at the current rate of production. So I think there is a bubble. It might not unfold here immediately, but when it does, I suspect oil prices are going to go down to the $40 to $70 range and probably stay there for a while.
What does this mean for the budget? I guess it'd be obviously traumatic if we go to the 40 range, but even what does it take at the present time to sustain our budget? What oil price?
Just so happened to know that number. David Teal testified before a committee. He's the legislative financial analyst, and he testified last week that current forecast is for next fiscal year's average to be $110 a barrel. That produces about a $400 million surplus. The break-even number is $106 per barrel, and currently we're at $99, which would generate $700-800 million deficit. But you got to remember, I mean, I think there's a big misconception here about the impacts of declining oil prices. The state has almost $20 billion of cash reserves outside the permanent fund. The state is the richest guy at the table in this whole game. The state government is bigger on a per capita basis than any other state, so we got a lot of places we could cut back. And so it's not going to be the state budget problem so much as it's going to be the rest of the economy that's going to really hurt if oil prices do take that long slide, because we've really subsidize a lot of drilling, and I think much of that will go away if oil prices fall. And those are going to be private sector jobs that are hurt, not state jobs.
You know, if I could jump in real quick, if I could jump in real quick, the thing that surprises me is that people are surprised at the volatility of oil. It seems that us as a society and a government, we get used to prices. I mean, it wasn't that long ago prices were $40 a barrel, and we had hundreds of millions in the CBR instead of billions. And so, you know, we tend to, as it was only 3 or 4 years ago where people said oil never hit $100 a barrel. That's insane. And now we actually count on oil being above $100.
Paul, is we've been here and known what $9 oil. We've seen oil prices.
That's right. You pay more for a red salmon than
you
would for a barrel of oil.
Yeah, and that became a wonderful metaphor that was used over and over again. Yet somehow, when we get the high oil prices, we think we're God's children and this is what we deserve. And
Alaska,
unfair here.
Alaska is the Athabascan word for boomer. That's pretty much what it was. We assume that if things go bad, something will save us. We are the most, faithful people on the planet. We just assume
faith-based economy is that what we're talking about?
Pretty much, and I agree with him. It's not going to happen overnight. It'll take 5 years, $15 billion to burn up out of reserves, but it's going to happen. During the Murkowski administration, when they had the 55 people get together and they decided. Well, income tax, surprise. When they got up there and did that, they released a study, the Murkowski administration did, that said, well, we'll lay off 1,700 state workers out of 15,000. And the economic impact, as he points out, spread out through the state, and it was devastating for just 1,700 people being laid off. So our we should start now. We shouldn't be waiting for the end of that 5 years.
Don't be crying for the state government.
It's huge.
It's the rest of the economy that's going to really take it in the shorts.
That's
if
where
this oil prices collapse.
And I guess, Greg, just finally, but if we're going to cut the state government, it's been so hard for us to look these constituencies in the eye and say we're laying you off.
Well, you know, it really hasn't been. If you look back to the 90s when Governor Knowles was facing a Republican-dominated legislature and oil prices that went down briefly to $9 a barrel, they put a clamp on things. They had capital budgets of $100 million a year. I mean, we are the only state in the nation that has capital budgets even we're seven times the size of the average state in terms of capital budget. So the capital budget has been a balance wheel that's always gone up and down as oil prices have gone up and down. And surely that would happen again. We had a big capital budget this year, last year, and the year before. We can go back to having small ones again. And if we don't use up all our bonding capacity with pension obligation bonds, we can always borrow for those capital projects.
Okay. Sean, bears are in the paper almost as much as militiamen these days.
Yeah.
And the question continues to be, how do our grizzly and black bear friends and the rest of us that live in peace and harmony, we seem to be having a hard time sorting it out.
Well, you know, it's one of those things. Are there more actual encounters with bears, or are we just paying more attention? It's difficult to say. You know, the problem is our big wildlife. We live in an area, small little bowl area with lots of streams full of fish that bring the bears down from the mountains into the urban areas. And then, of course, there's things that the bears find when they're down here that go along with being in an urban area, and that's trash. So, you know, people that want to see the bears would say, well, it's a people problem. You have to deal with the trash. And then there's people who say, well, no, this is the city. We shouldn't have brown bears, certainly, walking through. I will tell you, there's been bears seen around this studio. I took my son fishing about a week and a half ago at Cheney Lake, and a bear came within about 10 feet of us. And then later in that week, a bear actually came up and started sniffing on the back of a guy while he was walking his kid in a stroller. So it certainly seems, at least from the water cooler, that there's been a lot more bear encounters. A man was mauled pretty seriously out there at Bird Creek. Another guy had a pretty bad bear encounter at his place in Eagle River. What's the answer? I don't know. Now, as we've joked about before on this program, I am from Fairbanks, and you can insert your own joke there. But up in Fairbanks, they don't really have a lot of bear problems, which is kind of odd because it's a more urban area. Now, they do allow bear hunting right around Fairbanks, yeah, which they don't certainly in Anchorage because of the parks, but you know, there's other things. Fairbanks doesn't have the salmon streams
That's
to bring the bears
thing,
down.
I think,
absolutely,
yeah.
And I think it's location, location, location. We have to decide as a society, are we going to address this as a people problem, or are we going to address this as an animal problem? And frankly, I think that there's people on both sides of that, and until they come up with a plan to deal with it, I think we're still going to be talking about this. I think the interesting thing is there's no real long-term look at how do we cohabitate with bears. And not for nothing, you've got a lot more to worry about from moose. There's a lot more moose encounters that go unreported, and a lot more people are hurt by moose.
The mandatory verb stomp is what comes
absolutely in. So when we talk about how dangerous bears are, well, moose are even more dangerous whether you hit them in your car or you come around a corner and you run onto a cow with a calf. So it's a conversation I think needs to get started, and maybe at least this year we'll get that going.
Down in Juneau, we've had a very effective public education campaign and really worked hard on the garbage, and we haven't had a bear euthanized there for a long time, and we have salmon streams and right, a very compact area with lots of bears. So it can be done.
It can be, but you know, one of the problems is it's costly. Those bear-proof garbage containers cost you money, and then Anchorage is a huge urban area. I think it's fair to say you're never going to fully eliminate the garbage problem, but if there's a lot less of it, then there's a lot less reason for the bears to stray from those.
And the diversity of Anchorage, there's a huge difference between 4th Avenue and someplace at the extreme end of the Anchorage Bowl. Mm-hmm. The conditions that prevail.
Absolutely, you would expect to see a bear in Bear Valley, for instance, and maybe not so much at Cheney Lake.
Paul, the Republican State Convention didn't get off the ground last week. The old guard and the new guard are feuding, and they can't even get together and form a quorum. What happened, and what are the implications, if any, for the fall campaign?
So you guys, I was going to interject, while you guys are worried about bears, I have a hoary marmot that has taken up residence under my deck, and I can't get rid of them. So anyway, everybody's got their own problem. The Alaska
you better
GOP.
Not get rid of it.
Isn't it the state
it's the
vermin
state
or something?
Vermin, yeah.
Yeah,
we have a state vermin? Rodent, actually.
Yeah. Rodent, there you go. At the major convention end of April, pretty much without notice, the Ron Paul supporters seized control of the Alaska Republican Party, or at least set it up to seize control in February, when Randy Rudrick, the current chairman, has to step down. The new chairman, Russ Millett, will take over, a guy that nobody really knows. In the Republican Party, they thought, well, you know, we didn't get all the work done during the convention, the Russ Millett crowd did. why don't we have like a continue the convention? And we'll essentially there's a couple things that work here. One, they want the seas to power now, not wait till February. We've got an election in November. And they wanted to do some other thing. They wanted to, they want to censure Lisa Murkowski for not being nice to Joe Miller. They wanted to censure a couple of other people just to censure them.
Didn't they want to grab some money, too?
There's $100,000 out there floating around.
They pulled that out, remember, before the election, because they saw that coming.
So the fight now is it's never about the money, but of course it is. They want the money for their own candidates, the people they want. They want to go after the six Republicans who are in the Senate coalition, even though some of those Republicans are stalwarts, I guess, for the Republican Party. The Republican Party has always come off, in my mind anyway, as a fairly organized, fairly dedicated, target-focused organization. I'm not so sure anymore. It could very easily turn into a clown car. I'm sorry. In my own mind, I just see this. This is not a good thing.
Well, and in some ways, it's kind of a
wonder. It is for you.
Well, and let's not forget, the reason that they didn't get their continued convention is because Randy Reidrick, the current chair, cut them off.
Yeah,
he told everybody to go fishing. Actually, that
hit
weekend, so they couldn't get a quorum. I think there were actually 80 people under what they needed to
and
get
So
there.
He made a lot of friends that day. And so essentially, it's and for the elections themselves, the Republican Party has always been out there working hard, getting Republicans elected, picking the right people to run against Democrats. I don't know that that's going to happen in the future, but it might. It might turn out okay.
We'll see how smart we all are come November. Greg, we discussed the decline in oil prices. Let's go on here. What else is needed to keep oil prices up? Is there anything we can do?
No.
Now, this applies to the president as well. This is a true. Maybe you could give us a lecture on markets here.
Sure, the president has some levers that he or she can pull, but basically it's a worldwide traded commodity, and the prices are far more. If anybody has control, it's OPEC, and I think it's fair to say they don't have a lot of control either. It's also a market that is in disequilibrium right now in a couple of important ways. The fact that on a BTU per dollar basis, the natural gas is so much cheaper now than oil. And that can't persist for a long time. And we're seeing that eroded away as coal and petroleum lose customers in the power generation sector, and natural gas picks it up. Natural gas, high prices, even though they're much lower than they are for petroleum, the drilling technology developments that have made North Dakota the second highest producing oil state, displacing Alaska recently, are kinds of things that are responses to these high prices that we've had. So in a sense, it's a self-correcting system. It doesn't always work smoothly, and the bubbles are kind of the jerks in that correction process. So
we do have a couple of minutes here, and couple extra minutes, and let's try something that is very different. Frank Murkowski reemerged, our former governor and senator, with a really big idea, a tunnel to where?
Nowhere. Now, as most Alaskans will remember, at least who were here in the last few years, there's been a tremendous controversy about bridges to nowhere. Right. And the first bridge to nowhere was the bridge from Ketchikan to Gravina Island.
It was on the cover of Parade magazine.
Yeah, oh, it's been on other covers too. It's the poster child, I guess, for unwise public infrastructure spending. And Ketchikan happens to have its airport on Gravina Island, and people in Ketchikan hate to have to get on that ferry and pay whatever it is that they have to pay to. So they figured, with some justice, that they could get $500 million to build that bridge of federal money. Well, it got wrapped up around the axle of the Bridge to Nowhere title that got stuck on it. Frank Murkowski this last week said, well, if you can't build a bridge to nowhere, how about a tunnel? We could build a tunnel and nobody would be worried about it because it's not a bridge to nowhere anymore. I think that this has got to suggest that Frank Murkowski is no smarter now than he was when he was governor.
That's mean.
Well, maybe he, I mean, He's in the visionary tradition. Wally Hickel wanted to build a tunnel to Asia.
And let's not forget the water pipeline to California. That was my favorite project, actually.
Well,
there's another possibility. If you think big and say something big, you'll get your name in the papers and people will remember
you. And he did. And he did. And he got himself on Anchorage Edition, which I'll bet we haven't had Frank Murkowski on Anchorage Edition for quite a long time.
Okay, we have about a minute left, and I'm going to take something a little bit less than a minute to talk about the militiaman trial, the three Fairbanks men on trial, the federal courthouse here in Anchorage. The case went to the jury on Thursday, and we are at this point are awaiting a jury verdict. Let me tell you a little bit about the summary, the final argument. Steve Strzoki appeared for the government and made the case. They go first and then go last. He went into great detail about the conspiracy that the three defendants allegedly had put together to kill federal officials, went through all the names. He had charts. He had immense detail. It was very vivid, the presentation he gave.
He's a federal prosecutor from here.
The defense, Nelson Traverso, speaking on behalf of Schaefer Cox, really gave a presentation that was very much a cri de coeur. You do not punish this young man for having the courage to speak. And next week, I'll have time to get to the other two defendants and what became of them if we have a verdict by then. But right now we're waiting, and thank you very much for joining us on Alaska Edition.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskaedition@alaskapublic.org. Or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.